You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 21st, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Mark Leon Goldberg, the editor of UN Dispatch, the host of UN Dispatch podcast, is here, or not exactly here, but on the phone, to talk about a possible genocide in Burundi, political crisis in the Great Lakes region in Africa, why terrorism is spreading in West Africa, and Al-Qaeda's presence in that region. Also, who is the next Secretary General of the UN going to be? Where are they going to come from? How are they going to be positioned? And we might touch on the last three Secretary Generals, Boutros-Ghali, who recently passed away, Kofi Annan, and Ban Ki-moon. Also on the program, President Obama, historic visit to Cuba. He's there now in Havana, resetting U.S. relations, the first president since Calvin Coolidge to visit that country. And George Will, he's worried that Donald Trump is making the Republicans a white party. I thought, to the extent that people have any idea who George Will is, he was doing that himself. Reince Priebus, it's the media's fault that the black fellas get punched at the Trump rallies because they just keep focusing on it. Our beleaguered, sad RNC head attempts to make the media a culprit in the rise of clown fascism. It is, but not in the way he says. Hillary Clinton's addressing AIPAC today. Bernie Sanders skipped it. And inquiring minds want to know if some rabbis and activists are rightly boycotting Trump's speech at AIPAC, why aren't they also boycotting Benjamin Netanyahu? Talk about Trumpism in the Middle East. What's really happening in Brazil as the political warfare between the opposition and the presidency of Dilma Rousseff and her predecessor Lula, Ernesto Lula da Silva, intensifies? We'll look at some of the deeper questions at play in Brazilian politics. All that and so much more on today's Majority Report. I want to thank everybody who has written reviews of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I think there's about 70-something up now. All of you have subscribed. I couldn't be more excited about what we're doing. And you can subscribe. I have to ask you, if you go to 2DB.com, 2DBpod.com, you can subscribe on iTunes, and it makes a huge difference. I'll put up a link to it on the website.
I also put up a non-iTunes link on the Two Dope Boys Pod website as well.
Yeah. Oh, great. How do you think we're doing?
I think we're crushing it. We made it to the front page on three different silos and in all of iTunes, and new and noteworthy. So if people want to write reviews, now's a good time to do it because it genuinely moves us up higher in the iTunes marketplace real estate.
Yeah, so just search in iTunes. I actually, for whatever reason, the 2DB is not coming up for me at the moment, so I hope I'm not misremembering that. But you can go to iTunes and search Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. Do you have it?
Well, the official website is two, spelled T-W-O, Dope Boys Pod.
Right, and then there was another site that was with the number, I think it was like 2DB, subscribe, excuse me, it's subscribe 2DB pod. .com. Could you look that up for me while I'm doing the rest of this? Anyways, I appreciate everything. We're working on it, and we have a new one we're going to be recording on Tuesday night. Do you have that? Okay. If you find
just, go to Two Dope Boys Pod, T-W-O, Dope Boys Pod, .com, and that's the official website. You'll find the links there.
And you have links to everything you need, or you can just search us on iTunes. Thank you so much, everybody who's already given feedback and is listening. Today's show is brought to you partially by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As an advisor to a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. I can also tell you that posting a job in one place just isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed and there's no real time to deal with dozens of different job sites, until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post up to 100 plus job sites with a single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And again, a third time, that is ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Matt, you keep it clean shaven.
Yep, mainly.
Can you grow a beard?
You know
not
what?
To put you on
I'm
spot.
Getting close there.
Okay. Yeah. Kelly, are you pro beard or anti beard?
Pro.
Pro beard.
Both.
Beards are popular.
Both. Well, I don't want. I mean, if it gets crazy, like you're trying to make some sort of.
It's got to
point,
be groomed.
It's got to be groomed.
Oh, my sister's husband has a wizard beard, and I am anti wizard beard. I will say that. It's very disturbing. But
there you have it.
You know, a mix of both.
A mix of
mix
both.
Mix it up. Well, not at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I think that where I'm at right now is kind of like my ideal state. I like a little stubble. I like a little scruff. I don't like a full thing, but I don't like totally clean shaven. And this takes something to maintain. And with my Harry's razor, I can maintain it like this too. And I can give myself a great clean shave. And, you know, I use Harry's regularly. It's just an incredible product. I mean, once you use Harry's, there's no turning back because why would you? It's a complete no-brainer.
And I can attest that it's the best of those mail-order blades.
Oh, absolutely. And it's better than anything you can find in the store that isn't, you know, like the price of like buying like a, you know, a Jetcraft engine. And,
also true.
Yeah, and Harry's is still better. So look, here are some options. Option one, guys. Everyone knows that good things come in three sets. And ladies, what does that have to do with anything? Well, get this. March is the third month of the year. It also happens to be our friend over at Harry's third year anniversary as a business. And if you're new to Harry's, you get a special deal for to try three of their expertly crafted five-blade German razors, handle, and shave cream for just $10 with the offer code MajorityReport. That's offer code Majority Report. Option two, guys, March Madness is almost underway. You're probably scrambling to figure out which teams are good this year, and yet we all know that someone from the office is going to randomly fill out their bracket and beat you anyway. What you really should be doing is figure out how to get a good clean shave at an affordable price. And by the way, if you like Cinderella stories, a startup by the name of Harry's is taking on the razor giants and winning people over left and right. It's absolutely true. I never, ever touch anything else besides Harry's now for my shaving experience. It's the best shave I've had in a long time. It's the best maintenance of stubble I've had in a long time. And, you know, look, every time you go to Duane Reade, I just look and I think, wow, I've taken the blue pill. Or the red pill, excuse me, the red pill. I'm out of the matrix of these ridiculous overpriced blades. Harry's is the only shaving company that has both amazing quality and low prices. Quality German-engineered five-blade cartridges, close, comfortable shaves, no cuts, no burns. Quality guaranteed, full refund if you're not happy. Price, factory, direct prices. Cut out the middleman. Ships right to your door and sells blades at half the price of leading brands. Over a million guys have already made the switch and thousands more make it every day. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when you can get them at half the price at harrys.com? The Harry starter set is an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor, shave cream, and 3 blades. Harry's doesn't like to do discounts because their prices are already really low, but we've worked out a special offer for you guys. Harry's will give you 5 off of your first order with promo code Majority Report. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to harrys.com right now. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter promo code Majority Report at checkout. We will be right back with Mark Leon Goldberg. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mark Leon Goldberg. He is the editor of UN Dispatch and host of the podcast Global Dispatches, which I should tell you, Mark, I've been listening to and I really enjoy.
Nice. That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. It is kind of like, I think you said this somewhere, maybe on this show, actually. You said it was sort of like the WTF of foreign policy. And it's true, although I think you're a little bit more... You're functioning at maybe a little bit of a better psychological level than Marc Maron.
That's funny. That's what Sam said last time I was on the show.
Okay. Well,
We hope. But yeah, I mean, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. You know, you can let me know like 25 minutes when we're done this show if I'm sane enough for you.
Do you want to write a sketch together where we do a kind of faux Maron opening monologue, but it's about like Libya or something? You're just like, you know, man, I was reading about... you want to do something like that? There's a lot of possibilities.
It can be done.
Yeah.
It can be done.
All right.
Nothing stopping us.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping us. Let's look at that later. We're going to start the conversation today with the situation in Burundi. And I think it's being quite honest and upfront that this is obviously not a country or a region, the Great Lakes region in Africa, which receives that much attention. It's not on people's radar. But part of the reason that we want to sort of have this conversation to be a little bit anticipatory is that we already know, to the extent that people are aware of this region, that there has been tremendous conflict and human suffering in the Congo, and particularly the Eastern Congo. We know going back to the mid-90s that there was a genocide in Rwanda that reverberated across this region. And now we have a situation in Burundi that is certainly kind of low intensity and consistent human rights violations, but some people think it could spill out into something even much larger. So we want to track it. And maybe in some ways play a small role in preventing a catastrophe, if that's in any way possible. But before we get there, help set the stage for what's happening in Burundi by working us backwards in terms of...
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
No problem. So I suspect most of your listeners, most of you guys out there, are probably aware of the genocide in Rwanda, which occurred in April 1994. The incident that set off that genocide was the downing of a plane that was carrying both the prime ministers of Rwanda and Burundi. In Rwanda, that set off 100 days of violence, which killed 800,000 people. The situation in Burundi, by contrast, has been more of a slow burn, a long slow burn, over the course of 12 years, from 1993 to 2005, some 350,000 people were killed. And it never sort of caught the attention of the international community in the same way that the Rwanda genocide did. But its sort of implications and human rights violations were still, I think, exceedingly grave. The civil war in Burundi was sort of formally starting to end with the signing of a peace agreement in 2000 called the Arusha Peace Accords, mm-hmm. which created essentially a multi-party, multi-ethnic democracy in Burundi to start in 2005. In 2005, a man emerged to lead Burundi. He was a former rebel leader. His name is Pierre Nkurunziza, actually a former phys ed teacher, then became a rebel teacher, and then became president of Burundi.
It's a nice career trajectory.
It was. Yeah. And he still fashions himself very much like a soccer superstar and an athletic superstar in his sort of public-facing image. But in general, though, so he took power in 2005 amidst great hope that this would be the start of a long and enduring democratic transition in Burundi. And it started off well, but soon he started to adopt the trappings of authoritarianism, consolidated power very closely around a tight-knit circle. And this most recent episode, this most recent crisis, was precipitated in a decision last year by Nkurunziza to seek a constitutionally dubious third term in office. Theoretically, there were term limits that he should have abided by, but he sought to influence the judiciary to enable him to seek a constitutionally dubious third term in office. And there were street protests once he decided that he was going to seek a third term. Those street protests were violently suppressed. And in the process, there was a brief coup against Nkurunziza. That coup itself was also suppressed. And now we're in the situation today where there is just an ongoing slow grind of low-level violence and human rights violations, a lot of assassinations. At the height of the violence, there's mass graves found where we had like 80 bodies dumped. There are now 250,000 people living as refugees in countries neighboring Burundi. And it is the kind of situation that many people feel is like a precursor to an all-out civil war. And given the history of the region, that civil war may devolve into something much worse, like a genocide or some sort of mass atrocity event.
And also feed into potential instability in its neighbors, in Uganda, Congo, and Rwanda. A question that I think is valuable for to get into is, when we talk about these conflicts, whether they're in the Middle East or Africa, there are these sort of shorthand descriptions. You know, there's the president, there's the rebels, there's the, you know, there's the opposition, there's protests. I think it's helpful to get a sense of how do these things break down. I mean, it seems like there's sort of three tracks. There's one story that you have leaders that are clinging to power, have authoritarian or kleptocratic instincts, and then there's a civil society that rises up against them. We actually saw an inspiring example of this in some respects in Burkina Faso last year. Then there's ethnic politics, and that's sort of that, you know, political parties essentially are just kind of organized representation of group identity and questions of identity. And then, you know, third, I think that there's also a notion that people might be curious about of, you know, who's the right-wing party? Who's the left? What is the relationship to, you know, fiscal policies, to global corporate investment? Are all of those three things at play in Burundi, or is this primarily about a single guy or an ethnic conflict?
I think it's sort of all of the above. To be honest, I think the ethnic dimensions of this conflict might be overplayed a bit by the media. I mean, Nkurunziza himself, you know, he represents a Hutu majority party, and he himself is a mixed son of I think a Tutsi mother and a Hutu father. But his base of support are, you know, Hutu is a Hutu youth movement that's sort of like a wing of the government apparatus that is not officially part of the government apparatus. And that's actually something that is very common in these kinds of potential mass atrocity situations where you have official chains of command, say through the army, that follow orders through an official chain of command. And then you have sort of militias or other groups that may have some sort of unofficial link to political leadership. And they are the ones that typically carry out the mass atrocities. And you actually saw this play out in the Balkans and in Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, where the groups that were actually committing the atrocities were not the Serbian military. They were sort of organized gangs that had some affiliation with the Serbian political elite. And you have something like that going on where there's this youth wing in Burundi called the Imbarnar Kure, and they are terrorizing political opposition right now and likely responsible for a lot of the human rights abuses that, that we're seeing today. But your other point about civil society is really important. And very much they're the canary in the coal mine here, like the press freedom and the ability to just, you know, group together. I'm like one of the sort of early signs that Nkurunziza was going to be more an authoritarian than a Democrat after the Arusha peace accords was his slow and steady limiting of spaces for civil society, NGOs to operate. He even went so far as to ban running clubs, jogging clubs. Like jogging is sort of a big pastime in Burundi. And at one point now to be like, to be, if you're going to jog in like a group of more than like three or four, you have to register with the government and they need everyone's name. I mean, it's that it's getting that authoritarian. And you're seeing something similar across the way in Rwanda as well, where Paul Kagame also is making moves to adopt a constitutionally dubious third term. That country is security wise a bit more stable than Burundi. So no one thinks that Kagame's attempt to get a third term is going to devolve into a some sort of civil war. But you can also see that Kagame has placed huge restrictions on press freedom. There is no free press in Rwanda right now. And again, these are people who started out as rebel leaders, had the potential to be inspiring Democrats, but turns out they are just authoritarians and are plunging their countries into potential crises.
Yeah, and we'll get into actually this is a good point to sort of pivot because we'll sort of work our way outwards to the kind of global dimensions and global response to Burundi. But let's start with the neighbors. It's interesting you mentioned Rwanda, and maybe you could touch a little bit more on Kagame because, unlike in Nkurunziza, Kagame still has this kind of global fandom. I mean, it's toned down a little bit recently, yeah. But he was the go-to guy for, you know, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Davos. Anytime people wanted to point to a leader from the Great Lakes region in Africa, someone who understood the economy, someone who understood fighting corruption. And Kagame is a very kind of, you know, he has an image of, there's a lot, he's very measured, he's obviously mm-hmm. very intelligent, but he's, you know, and he's played along with Western economic policies, but clearly he is a tremendous authoritarian tendencies, and more to the point of this conversation, seems to play questionable roles in his neighborhood, as does mm-hmm. obviously Museveni in Uganda, and as in, you know, in the Eastern Congo, and this is not necessarily a stabilized situation. The African Union has been establishing, I think, a bit more credibility for sort of an ability to self-police the continent as well. And one of the ironies of this is that Burundi is a very important contributor to AU peacekeeping forces across the continent. So what's the neighborhood mm-hmm. response to Burundi, and what's the continental response to Burundi?
So the neighborhood does not want to see Burundi devolve into a full-scale civil war that would create more refugees to flow across their borders and potentially have destabilizing effects across the region. The African Union, acting in concert with the governments of Tanzania, Uganda, and Rwanda, also are trying to play a constructive role in Burundi. The problem is, Nkurunziza seems to be immune to any sort of means of compellence or any sort of diplomacy. He just doesn't care what the rest of the world seems to think of him mm-hmm. right now. The African Union, for example, opted and voted amongst themselves to dispatch a peacekeeping force to stabilize the situation in Burundi. They're going to send something like 5,000 peacekeepers to Burundi. And Nkurunziza said, you know, over my dead body, you know, he said that if the African Union were to send peacekeepers to his country, he would dispatch the Burundian army to fight them. Now, the African Union is not going to, like, invade and occupy Burundi. They have to, their peacekeepers can only operate in a context in which the government of Burundi consents to their being there. The government of Burundi did not consent to their being there. And another complicating factor about this, which you alluded to before, is that Burundi is actually a supplier of peacekeepers to the African Union's mission in Somalia. Mm-hmm. And with that mission, you know, is having a tough time, but by and large is doing a good job of moving Somalia in the right direction. And Burundi is an important contributor of peacekeeping troops to that mission. So there is, like, a degree of high-level diplomacy at stake. But the bottom line is, and you saw this all, the bottom line is that Nkurunziza does not seem to be swayable by much international diplomacy. And you saw this also with a recent UN Security Council trip to Burundi. Now, you know, Burundi, as you allude to earlier, is on no one's top priority list. It is mm-hmm. at most a tertiary foreign policy priority. So it is highly significant that the UN Security Council, each member, including Samantha Power, who led the delegation, would go to Burundi to meet with Nkurunziza to try and, you know, bring about some sort of peaceful resolution to this crisis. And they have been more or less rebuffed at every turn. Mm-hmm. Another indication of Nkurunziza's unswayableness, if I can invent a term, is that, you know, Burundi relies a lot on external foreign aid, particularly from the European Union, to fund its government, to fund its operations. The EU threatened to suspend its aid and then finally did suspend its aid earlier this year. And that did not seem to have any sort of effect on Nkurunziza's political calculus. So we're left with a situation where a country and a government that is on nobody's priority list is tiptoeing ever steadily towards a potential civil war. And the person leading the country over the cliff does not seem to be swayable by any international diplomacy, either regionally or internationally.
It's a final question on Burundi before we move to West Africa. I mean, I understand, I guess, in some sense, just the desire to have and maintain power at all costs. Maybe I shouldn't be admitting that publicly. But, I mean, I think that there's this sense that, you know, anybody, frankly, in politics, from the sort of, you know, from the most noble, you know, from, you know, to this, you know, Mandela, Gandhi, whatever, to the sort of middling, to the kleptocratic, to the dictator. I mean, obviously, there is a universal desire for power and to engage in it. But, you know, this obsession for getting more terms that seems to occur again and again in the African continent, it can't just be specific to African leaders. I mean, obviously it isn't. We see it at a lot of other places. And it can't just be that all of these guys have the same, and most of them are guys, have the same you know, value systems, the same instincts. And I guess, I mean, is there ever examples, and it doesn't sound like this is one, where the concern is, you know, if I give up power, I'm going to end up getting arrested by my successors when they expose corruption. Or if I give up power, there's a whole, you know, patronage network that ensures that my villages, my network, my family is taken care of, and that will collapse. I guess I'm wondering, what are like the practical and bureaucratic reasons for this clinging beyond just, you know, the ego of it? I mean, there has to be something more in some of these cases, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think each situation differs.
Right, sure.
I think there's a bit of like egoism. I think, for example, Paul Kagame, I think thinks he's the only one who can deliver and keep delivering for Rwanda the amazing growth that they have experienced. And they have experienced tremendous economic growth and are improving on all sorts of social and development indicators. I would say, though, that the experience across the African continent is not monolithic. For example, the largest African country by far, Nigeria, one in every six Africans is a Nigerian. They just experienced a peaceful election that transferred power from the ruling party to an opposition party. And their country is also, parts of their country, is in the midst of a war and insurgency with Boko Haram. Yet despite those challenges, and despite Nigeria's many challenges, they were able to have a very successful democratic transition. They're the most high-profile example, but there have been other examples across the continent over the last few years where you have seen this kind of democratic transition, and you do see the peaceful passing of power from one party to another. So I don't think, you know, you can't really overgeneralize, although in this particular region of the Great Lakes, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, DRC, that particular sub-region is a sort of hotbed for what's being known as third termism.
Okay. So let's move to West Africa for a bit before we wrap up. You just mentioned Nigeria, which you're right, just had a successful democratic transition. And Boko Haram is obviously the sort of prime security concern in Nigeria. But across the Western Africa, there is this sort of growth of Al-Qaeda-linked terrorism, of sort of this kind of, you know, this type of politics and terrorism, this which is analogous to ISIS, which sometimes is officially connected to it, or Al-Qaeda affiliates. And I guess the first question I have for you, and I think this is something that I've appreciated about your work, is when we talk about these groups, obviously through ideology, through tactics, through security threats, they're all connected. However, you know, you can notice going to the Middle East, obviously, you know, ISIS does have this sort of almost kind of global imperial fantasy of a caliphate that really sort of drives it. And then you can go to, you know, Al-Qaeda in Mali as an example, which on a humanitarian level, there's no difference in terms of its willingness to absolutely brutalize civilians and engage in terrorism. But it might be a little bit more profitable to look at the local and contextual reasons as to why, you know, the specific grievances that drive this group in conjunction with a broader kind of ideological framework. So if that kind of distinction makes sense, can you give us a way of understanding what's happening in West Africa that has to do more with just the sort of global spread of these ideas or the very specific conditions that some groups find themselves in the western part of the continent?
Sure. So since the end of last year, you've seen three really high-profile terrorist attacks committed by al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, an al-Qaeda-linked group in West Africa. And all of these attacks were on Western targets, Western hotels particularly. I don't know, in most of these pretty poor countries in West Africa and throughout much of Africa, usually have one or two really fancy hotels that Westerners stay at, that foreign investors stay at. And these have been the targets of attack by these groups. So in November, you had a Radisson Hotel attacked in the capital of Mali, Bamako, by an Islamist, by a jihadist group. Then in January, in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, you had another attack against a Western hotel. And this is significant for the fact that, unlike Mali, which has struggled with an Islamic insurgency, a jihadist insurgency, particularly in its north, Burkina Faso has never experienced an attack like this before. Mm-hmm. And then, similarly, just last week in Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, you had another attack against the Western target, although it was a target often used also by the elites in Côte d'Ivoire, basically like a beachfront hotel. They attacked a beach, killed something like 19 people. In Burkina Faso and in Côte d'Ivoire, these are both two Francophone countries with strong connections to the French government. The French government 2 years ago led an international intervention against jihadist groups in Mali as those jihadist groups were threatening to overrun the country and even potentially overtake the capital city of Bamako. There had been a civil war ongoing in Mali that, for complicated reasons, can actually trace its roots to the fall of Gaddafi. Some of the groups that he armed then went to Mali and sowed instability there. And that led to a civil war and a coup in Mali for sort of like a long, complex history. But the point is, Mali had a functioning government, then a non-functioning government, and then was stuck in a civil war. The French and the United Nations intervened, put a stop to the advances of the jihadist groups. And since then, the jihadist groups have reconstituted themselves and have been waging a pretty, a low-level insurgency against international targets in West Africa. And like I said, you sort of expect this to happen in Mali, which is in the context of a civil war. You did not expect this to happen in Burkina Faso, which I think you referenced earlier had its own kind of very hopeful Arab Spring moment last year, in which a popular protest peacefully overthrew a ruler of 30 years in the country and was just getting on its feet, had free and fair elections, and was setting up a true multi-party democracy in Burkina Faso. And then this attack happened. In Côte d'Ivoire, another country that was emerging from civil conflict, from a civil war dating back to 2010. And that country is now experiencing really, really rapid economic growth. It's one of the fastest growing economies in the world, actually, is Côte d'Ivoire. And so this attack happens at really also another inopportune moment, where you have a country that is emerging from war and conflict, growing really rapidly, is now hit by this terrorist attack.
So in some ways, they're almost proxies for getting at France. Are you there? Yeah, we're here. All right. Sorry about that, folks. Mark Leon Goldberg was in the middle of a fantastic point, tremendous point. Sorry.
It was more of a rant, let's be honest.
Well, look, I actually thought it was a great rant. I'm just talking like Trump to you to ease everybody back in. And you were doing a fantastic job. So my question is these attacks in some ways, if you go after a Francophone country, is it a sort of proxy of attacking France or French interests in some respects? Is that what's happening?
Yes, possibly. Because again, these targets were international targets in the country. They were not targeting places where local Burkinabe or local Cote d'Ivoireans or Malians congregate. They're attacking places where the international community congregate. And, you know, the French are a stand-in for the international community in these places. So I do think that that is certainly, I think that the tie that binds these three attacks together. And the implications are, I mean, what does it say about other Francophone countries in the region? I mean, are they at, could they potentially, you know, come under attack sometime soon? Senegal, for example, is starting to beef up its own security and you know, needs to figure out if they're a country. Again, that's like that country is politically stable. It's a democracy. Could they come under attack? Right. Again, and these are not terribly resilient places. So these kinds of attacks have outside implications, have implications far beyond what it would have in a country that can absorb an attack, say like France or the United States.
Sure. So let's actually just take just a moment before we go, because I know you are really, I mean, you're a very important sort of translator of the UN to an American and global audience through UN Dispatch. I want to know, I guess this is a two-part question, leading up to who might be the next UN Secretary General, and I guess there's the basic questions of where, you know, might we have the first woman UN Secretary General? Where is this going to? What continent will the next leader come from? What will their background be? But I also want to sort of get your sense, and I know that this is a little bit more speculative, but it seems to me, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, that the last three UN Secretary Generals really kind of exemplified three different ways of doing that position. And, you know, Boutros-Ghali, who recently passed away, who also did an amazing appearance in an Ali G sketch several years ago, was kind of known for, in addition to being an incredible sport on that sketch, was someone who was actually kind of eased out of his position or muscled out by the United States, and someone who had much more kind of overt sympathies and skepticism of a Western perspective, and more carried a more sort of you know, for lack of a better term, third worldist perspective. Then, you know, Kofi Annan, much more comfortable with the West, the United States, and very, you know, charismatic and media savvy in a certain way. He had a certain kind of star appeal. Ban Ki-moon seems a lot more low profile, but actually it seems like he's been fairly effective as well. So I guess actually starting with your kind of assessment of the last three, where do you think might we be heading for our next leader of the Secretariat?
So the next Secretary General will probably be a woman and probably be from Eastern Europe. There are two reasons I can say that. One is that there has been just a tremendous push over the last several years by Ban Ki-moon himself, among many others, to say that it's time to appoint a woman as head of the United Nations. And the UN member states have a sort of informal policy of rotating regions from which they pick the Secretary General. So Ban Ki-moon was from Asia. So in 2005, when he was appointed to his term, it was considered to be Asia's turn. And so Ban Ki-moon's competitors were other diplomats from Asia.
And that's all. That's South Asia, too, not like North Asia, but also like India, Singapore, Korea. Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. And so, you know, by a quirk of kind of Cold War diplomacy, Eastern Europe is considered its own region. It's not considered as part of Europe for like UN geographic rotational purposes. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, you have seen a number of candidates, many of them actually very well qualified, from Eastern Europe. The top candidates so far are a former foreign minister from Bulgaria named Irina Bokova, who is currently the head of UNESCO, the International Science and Culture Organization that's based in Paris. And she has her hat in the ring. The former foreign minister, or the current foreign minister of Croatia, Vesna Pucic, has her hat in the ring. There are a number of really actually very talented candidates from Eastern Europe who are emerging. And what's interesting from a UN perspective about this next selection of the Secretary General is that it's far more transparent than it has been in years past. In years past, the selection of the Secretary General has been made by really just five countries. The five permanent members of the Security Council collude amongst themselves to pick the next Secretary General, and no one really has any idea what goes into their selection processes. This time around, there is a concerted effort to open up the process more, to the point where now you can visit a website on UN.org where you can read all the resumes of all the declared candidates. So there actually are officially declared candidates. You can read a cover letter and resume. And sometime next month, each of those candidates are going to go through a kind of, you know, hearing by the General Assembly. So think of it as almost like a Senate committee hearing where they're going to get grilled and ask questions. That'll be publicly available. Anyone can watch the webcast, or if you have a press pass, you can go watch it yourself, and have to go on the record with questions from member states about certain issues. And there might even actually be like an American-style debate that's still, I think, in the works. But in the end, the decision will still be made amongst the secretary, amongst the permanent five, but this time there's a lot more public input going into that decision. So we're going to know a little bit more about who the next Secretary General is before she, and I think it will be a she, actually takes office. Like, people didn't really know who Ban Ki-moon was. I mean, he was the foreign minister of Korea, South Korea, but he was not someone generally well known in the UN system. Kofi Annan was a little different because he actually had spent his entire career in the UN system. He used to be head of UN peacekeeping, so he was actually a very well-known entity. Ban Ki-moon was not. It was kind of like a mystery as to what he would be like as Secretary General. But coming in to 2017, January 1st, 2017, the next Secretary General will take office. We'll know a good deal more about what she's like.
Got it. Mark Liam Goldberg, so we have a potential very serious crisis in Burundi, and terrorism is expanding in West Africa, and then on a slightly positive note, we might have a really good next UN Secretary General.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it'd be fun to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark Liam Goldberg is the editor of UN Dispatch. He's the host of Global Dispatch podcast, which, again, I really recommend to everybody, after, of course, you know, Majority Report and Two Dope Boys. But,
yeah,
you know,
it's less me talking. I do most of the listening on my own podcast.
No, it's really, really good. And the range of people that you get, I mean, whether you're, I just, as an example, I listened to one recently with Robert Pape, who's a really important terrorism scholar. And it was also amazing to hear how he grew up with a, you know, a single mother who was a waitress who helped sort of, you know, build up his ability to have the career he's had. It's a great mix. So, Mark, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody, we are going to go to the fun half where we will take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. And we will take your IMs. The IM machine is already on. We have a bunch of sound to get to. President Obama in Havana. Some of the more sort of nonsense from the clown fascism campaign this past weekend. Writes Priebus, trying to blame this all on the media. George Will, I don't know if it's willful delusion. I don't know if it's I don't know what brand of delusion it is.
It's George Will delusion.
It's George Will delusion, and that is some pretty potent delusion. You should use our link, Amazon link, to if you're going to use it to buy your crap through Amazon. That makes a big difference to us. Check out jet.com. That's a socially responsible alternative to Amazon. You get 15% off of your first purchase. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Even if you're a member, it helps push up the ranks of the Majority Report. Write us a review on iTunes. That helps tremendously. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, and Chocolate. It's subscribe to the number 2, DB.com. Subscribe to DB.com. That's how you can get started on 2 Dope Boys. Really look forward to talking to you over there as well. We will see you in the fun half, members. Everybody else, have a good one.
new pain.